Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, how Utah's delegation in Washington responded to President Trump's Twitter tirade against four progressive Democratic women, why one Utah senator initially blocked a vote to extend funding to compensate victims of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, a rule change in the licensing process for growing medical marijuana in Utah, and the new model in homelessness provision that is ramping up in Salt Lake County. And joining me for this conversation is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. And good morning to you, Bethany.
Good morning.
We've also got Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. George, welcome to you.
Good morning.
And on the phone from Washington, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Berg. Good morning to you, Tommy.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. The number to call to join this conversation is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet your questions and comments to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And we will begin with Thomas Burr in Washington. And Tommy, the President of the United States, in some tweets, directed an old racist trope at some progressive members of Congress who are women of color. Thomas Burr, just so we have the quote in mind as we go through the conversation, if you have it in front of you, what were the president's words?
I actually do, and I want to be clear because there's some people who's misquoting him a little bit. But let's just read what he actually said. So he tweeted on Sunday, "So interesting to see progressive Democratic congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, if they even have a functioning government at all, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government should be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came and come back and show us how?" So he never said, go back to your country, but it's obviously clearly implied in what he stated.
Right. The countries, the governments, the crime-infested places. These comments were also pretty clearly directed at Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. They're kind of commonly known right now as the Squad. And a lot of people condemned these tweets. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who has had her own divide with these progressive freshman Democratic congresswomen, she also condemned what the president said and then later led a vote on a rebuke of the president on the House floor. I want to get to that vote, but first, the president's comments, they got a lot of reaction from around the country. How did Utah's delegation in Washington respond to these series of tweets, Tommy?
No, it was interesting to see how fast people responded. I think, one, people were a little stunned at first. Obviously, Democrats called him out. Republicans were a little slow to do so, and only a few actually did, including Senator Mitt Romney, who called the comments destructive and demeaning, that they fell short of the office, that we should expect more of a president. Congressman Ben McAdams, Utah's only Democrat in Congress, said they were offensive and beneath the dignity of the office. As for Senator Mike Lee, Congressman John Curtis, Rob Bishop, and Chris Stewart, well, do you have like a soundbite of crickets you could play or something?
Because
that's pretty much what we heard. We heard nothing. Mike Lee's office declined to comment. The other three Republicans in the House, their offices didn't even get back to me.
Wasn't there sort of a joint statement released by Representative Bishop, Curtis, and Stewart?
Yeah, I'm talking about initially. They did issue a joint statement after the House voted to condemn the president, and essentially saying that that we should be focusing on those things and not be worried about tweets.
Okay. Senator Romney, were his statements on this? I guess I'm wondering, were they kind of an outlier in the Republican Party? I mean, were there many other Republicans saying that Trump had gone too far with this "go back to your crime-infested countries" statement?
It really depends. There were some actually defending him pretty strongly, saying that he wasn't being racist and that these, people they're anti-Semitic or they're critical of their own country, and so they should be supportive and not critical. Romney was a bit of an outlier. There were some Republicans who came out strongly and said that condemned the president for what he tweeted, but most were, they were silent. There was a lot of people who just avoiding any talk of it. And if I can just circle back to Romney real fast, because I think this is an important point. He was asked specifically if he thought they were racist, and he pretty much dodged the question and didn't answer it.
Okay. Let's circle back then to the vote on the House floor that was condemning this statement. It was sort of a bizarre scene that played out in that chamber when it was brought for a vote. Can you describe that for us, Tommy?
Yeah, it was one of the weirdest things I think I've seen in covering Congress for more than 14 years, that Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker's on the floor, and she referred to the president's racist tweets, which prompted Republicans to try to they urged to take her words down as the phrase, which essentially would be strike what she said from the record and that she wouldn't be able to speak the rest of the day. And it was just bizarre because the Cleaver, who was on at the dais, like, you know, got frustrated, put his, you know, the gavel down and walked away. And it ended up being that her words were called out. She shouldn't have said them, apparently, even though the actual resolution they were voting on said they were racist tweets. So she was allowed to come. Pelosi was allowed to come back and speak, but her words were taken down. And the resolution passed 240 to 187. As you expect, it fairly much along party lines. Some Republicans crossed over. Congressman McAdams, again, Utah's only Democrat, voted for the resolution. Congressman Curtis, Bishop and Stewart opposed it. But let's remember, this doesn't do anything. It's the resolution. That's just the statement of the House, essentially.
Right, a statement, but a kind of rare one at the same time, or unusual.
Yeah.
I want to bring Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor George Pyle in on this. He's also a columnist at the paper. And you in your editorial board, you tackled this subject this week, actually, George. And I want to just get your view on first the president's statements and, you know, on that go back to where you came from line from the president to these women.
Well, yeah, clearly, as has been said elsewhere, this is an old racist phrase. I mean, somebody went and dug up the standards set out by the Federal Equal Opportunity Commission and Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and that is specifically is a phrase that if you say that in the workplace, you're supposed to be reprimanded for that. It's a racist thing to say. And this coincidentally happens right after the new Associated Press style book comes out, which is the Bible that we all refer to. And somewhat coincidentally, I suppose, or maybe not, the AP style book now says don't use phrases like racially tinged or racial overtones or something like that. If something is racist, call it racist. Be honest with your readers. Say what it is. And of course, they didn't provide a whole lot of guidance on what the word racist does mean. But they say you'll know it when you see it, and when you see it, you call it out. This is what that was. And then the rally, it's not just Trump is in the permanent campaign, but he goes around the country having rallies. And he went to North Carolina, and there was this chant about one of these members of Congresswomen, and they were saying, send her back. And he stood there and basked in that. And then the next day in the Oval Office, he said, well, you know, I didn't really like that. And the reporting out of Washington now is that his wife and daughter got after him because it looked really bad. So now he's trying to backpedal it. And we also say, well, can you use the word racist? And it's like, can you use the word lie? You know, lie is a deliberate intention to deceive. So if somebody says something that's not true, maybe they're just confused and they don't understand. So when you're saying, did the president say something racist? Yes, he did. Is the president a racist? Well, a lot of people have concluded that he is. In my mind, the more telling thing is all these politicians, whenever they say something, they're telling us what they think of us. They're telling us, I think this will get people to like me. And in Trump's universe, saying things that are racist, he thinks gets people to like him, so he keeps saying them.
I want to just quickly ask about that. You brought up a point about how the media has been covering this in the Associated Press style guide. A number of media outlets, including the Salt Lake Tribune, labeled Trump's tweets racist in headlines and in story leads and, you know, on the nightly news. The Tribune's headline was Romney, McAdams criticized Trump for his racist remarks, silence from Utah's other members. And I've been reading a lot about how those decisions were made in various outlets, Washington Post, NPR, and so on. And Tommy, I'll circle around to you in just a minute, but George, from your editorial position, are those outlets, I guess you've already said this, but they're calling it racist. I mean, you can define a lie as a lie. Sometimes that definition, that sort of moral judgment on what represents racism or language that is racist, maybe there's a distinction there to be made. But, you know, is that right for journalism to be doing?
Well, I think it is. And I think that we've been dancing around it for, you know, since the 60s probably, and at least. And now we're coming to a point where we're put in this weird universe since the last presidential election, where we're having to face questions we never had to face before, because especially after the 60s and you get into the national politics, nobody wanted to be accused of being racist, even if they were deep down, and they would be careful with what they said to avoid saying anything that could be perceived as being racist. And if they would stumble or say something stupid, you know, they didn't say it every day, so they had an opportunity to walk it back and apologize, and everybody would just go on. But when it's just day after day, hour after hour, and with the advent of social media that we didn't have before, and the president on Twitter all the time, so with no filter, then you have to face this in a way that the media does that we didn't have to before.
I've seen other arguments for dispassionate distance from journalists, that, you know, I might think a comment is disgusting or heinous or vile, but I'm not going to put that in my own words as a definition in the article, because, you know, who makes that moral judgment? But I can quote people. I can point to the context and history around the phrase. Again, George, I know you're a columnist, and I should probably be asking an editor about all of this. But what about that aspect of the sort of distance that journalists usually take in defining things? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I'm an opinion writer, so I have more leeway, and I call something out. And I would say also that, I mean, racist is something that's a little closer to having a definition than other words like disgusting or vile or something like that. Those are more value judgments where, you know, somebody could say, oh, I think that's vile, and somebody else would say, oh, it's just, you know, people talking, it's just don't get excited about it. But racist comes closer to being something that has a definition, and you'll know it when you see it.
Thomas Burr, your lead in that article says Senator Mitt Romney said Monday that President Donald Trump's racist attacks on four minority Democratic members of Congress were destructive and demeaning and fell short of unifying rhetoric befitting the nation's highest office. I'm guessing, you know, whether to use the R word was a conversation that you had with an editor or maybe more than one editor. Did that give you pause at all, or was that just defining?
No, it was a good discussion to have. I think it's important. I had it with, you know, my editor, who had it with our senior managing editor, Matt Canham, and we decided, you know, it is what it is. I'll put it this way. I can write in the story, the sky is blue. I don't need to say Democrats say the sky is blue. It is what it is, and in this situation, there's really no it's black and white. It is what it is.
I want to go back just for a second to the Tribune editorial that and kind of leave this discussion about how the media covers the president to one side. And there's this piece of writing in the Salt Lake Tribune's editorial board's response to the comments that President Trump made that I just want to, if you'll humor me, I want to read for you, because I thought it was a pretty remarkable piece of writing. And George, it says, a nation such as this one, a tapestry of every hue and belief, only holds together because we wish it to. And holding it together is perhaps the primary duty of our national government, not so much by law or appropriation or enumeration of rights and responsibilities, but by leadership, example, wise and considered words of unity and conciliation. Every president until now has taken that duty seriously, even if their words were sometimes weak, pro forma, or even hypocritical. This one has deliberately, even proudly, turned his back on all of that. The board goes on to say that it's time for Republicans and conservatives to reclaim their respective mantles and to separate themselves from this administration. George, again, the editorial voice on the show, do you see any signs of that happening, of members of his party, of President Trump's party, taking a stand like the one that your board is suggesting?
No, and I don't. And it's really sad. I mean, Mitt Romney has made a few noises in that direction. But even the Democrat, Ben McAdams, even while he denounced what the president said, he never actually used the word racist because it's so fraught. And I guess he was worried about saying that, going over that line. But no, I mean, we've always had partisanship in Washington, and whoever holds the White House, the members of the same party in Congress, whether they're in the minority or the majority, tend to back that president. And that's why when they finally started turning their back on Richard Nixon, it was such a big deal, because when members of your own party turn on you, that's a big deal. But this is one of the things that would make James Madison just puke, because his whole setup was that members of Congress would be jealous of the powers and the prerogatives of Congress, and they would stand up to the president. And when you have this partisan overlay on it, and members of Congress who happen to be of the same party as the president automatically fall in line with the president, they are not doing what the founders wanted them to do. The founders wanted this tension between the branches, and we're not seeing it, and I don't know if we're going to see it again.
Before we head to a break, actually, I want to bring Bethany Rogers in on this conversation for just a quick moment, because, Bethany, you wrote about some new polling that showed that the president's approval rating here in Utah has suffered, though not necessarily because of this exact issue. Can you tell us when this poll was conducted and essentially what it says?
So the poll was conducted late June through mid-July, and essentially it shows that among those polled across the state, 53% expressed some level of disapproval of President Trump's job performance. Now, actually, when I talked to the pollster, he said that's actually a slight bump compared to some of the other polling that he's seen of President Trump's popularity in Utah during his time in office. But it is low for a sitting Republican president in Utah.
Hmm. Well, and again, the very tail end of that coincided with these particular comments.
Yes.
Thomas Burr, before we head to a break, is there any more to the story that we've missed? And is this the end of the story, or are we kind of awaiting more fallout from these comments from the president?
The scary part is I think that we're going to see a lot more of this as we head into the 2020 election. And this is how Trump whips up his base. This is not the last time we're going to hear something like this. And the squad seems to be the new boogeyman for the president. So, yeah, I think we'll be writing about this for a while.
Okay. That's Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief for the Salt Lake Tribune, here on Behind the Headlines. We need to head to a break, but there's still more to come from this past week in Utah news. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and columnist George Pyle. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. Bethany Rogers, let's turn to some reporting that you did this week, and I think I would like to begin here in Salt Lake City, in the Salt Lake Valley, where new homeless resource centers are soon to be opened. You and your colleague Taylor Stevens spoke to a number of homeless people about this pending transition, and especially people making use of the current shelter, the Road Home Shelter, which is set to close, and what they're going to do in the wake of this new model. And you found that people aren't exactly sure what's happening, and then you found that maybe that's by design. Can you talk about who you spoke with about this this homeless shelter transition and what they said, especially from the people who are homeless?
We spoke with a number of people, as you said, who are currently staying at the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake. And a common theme was that they didn't have a lot of information about the upcoming transition. The first of the shelters is women's only, and it's supposed to open later this month. So we're only a couple weeks out from that. Then the other shelters will follow in the weeks after that, culminating with the closure of the Road Home Shelter sometime in October at this point. And so it's coming on quick, but people said that, you know, they hadn't had a whole lot of official communication, that they were learning most of what they knew they were hearing through gossip. They didn't really have an official person talking to them and explaining to them. They weren't really sure who the point person was for communications. And it's something that is going to affect people's day-to-day lives in a variety of ways, from affecting how they're able to get to work and the length of their journey to work, affecting their distance from certain services, affecting, you know, I spoke with a husband and wife couple who weren't sure that they would be able to share the same facility anymore. So there was just a lot of uncertainty surrounding this transition. Over the course, right before we went to publication, the team that was in charge of the transition did begin sort of a public outreach campaign. They began holding information sessions in the Wiegand Center, which is near the road home. It's sort of like a day gathering spot. And those information centers, there was an opportunity for people to ask questions about what was going to happen. But we were told by the transition team that, as you kind of alluded to, that there was a very deliberate timing here, that they wanted people in recent months to be more focused on finding housing and not on the expectation that they would be transitioning to an emergency shelter. So there was kind of a deliberate delay in the push of information to the community.
And that meaning that they're going to help people currently, that they're hoping to help people find housing as opposed to pushing them into the new model, the new homeless resource centers?
Yeah, they're trying to, that's a big piece of the upcoming transition, is trying to expand the amount of housing options. And instead of having people sort of chronically homeless for hugely long periods of time, really focusing on transitioning people out of emergency shelter and into those housing spots.
You mentioned the closure of the road home that's pending, and the these new shelters or homeless resource centers opening. There's also the fact that there are some of the service providers are staying close to where the road home currently is, and that's not exactly close to where these new shelters are going
to be.
Not
at all.
Right. So how does that gap? I mean, if you are at a shelter that is somewhere distant, but you need the services that are at, the area of the Pioneer Park / Rio Grande area, how do you access them? Or is it that they are also going to be at these resource centers?
It's a combination. So the idea of the reason the resource centers are called that rather than shelters is because they will be full of a lot of services that are currently unavailable at the road home, which it closes during the day. At these new shelters, people will be able to stay through the day. They'll have access to 3 meals a day. They'll have access to job assistance, health care, education services, case management. So there's a lot of things that will be provided directly in the shelter that people don't have currently at the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake. However, things like if people want to work a job that's downtown, if people do need more intensive health care, if people for some reason need to resolve some court case, that will be more difficult, especially for people who are staying at the men's shelter, which is going to be all the way in South Salt Lake. And we kind of mapped it out, and it's about 5 miles outside of the free fare zone, or nearly a 2-hour walk for people. And in talking with the transition team, there is no really comprehensive plan for how to transport those people to the downtown area at this point.
How will the transition be coordinated? You wrote about this group, Utah Community Action, helping with this. When people are say making the move from the Road Home Shelter or from wherever they are into the 3 new homeless resource centers, how is that going to happen, and when is it going to happen?
Yeah, so that has all been kind of a squishy timeline. The opening of the shelters has been delayed a couple times already. In fact, the Road Home Shelter in downtown Salt Lake was originally supposed to close, end of June. And now that's been pushed all the way to October. So the current plan is for the women's shelter to open later this month into early August. There's a co-ed shelter that's supposed to open a few weeks after that. And then the men's shelter in South Salt Lake is supposed to open in September. As you mentioned, there is an agent or a nonprofit that's dealing solely with sort of like intake and getting people into the right shelter. And so they're currently working with clients over at the Road Home and talking with the women who are staying there to figure out what the best placement is for them, if they can find them housing, if they can find them some kind of other spot to go, or if they belong over at the women's shelter. And so they're going to kind of be helping bring people over in groups.
Through this process, and repeatedly we've heard about the gap in beds, the shortage of beds that will result from the closure of the Road Home when these new resource centers open. Just between those three and the Road Home, there's the Road Home had more beds than these three shelters are going to have. Is that still sort of the reality of the situation? And what do leaders say about that? Again, I'm assuming it's about getting people into housing as opposed to into shelter.
Yeah, exactly. So they'll tell you that the housing piece is going to be a really big part of making up that gap in beds. But there's a lot of people out there who still say that it will be really insufficient, especially considering the affordable housing shortage here. You know, maybe the reluctance of some landlords to accept the vouchers that will allow people to stay in their complexes. So, yeah, I mean, I even covered a mayoral debate earlier this week where Aaron Mendenhall said that if the city doesn't get on top of this, they could be facing something like a humanitarian crisis this winter if people don't have a place to go and are stuck outdoors.
George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. The idea behind this new model is essentially siloing populations, that it'll be easier when everything is dispersed. But of course, that dispersal, as Bethany kind of alluded to, with maybe services being in one place or jobs being in one place and shelters being in another place, that presents its own challenges. But it's kind of ready or not. Here we go. If we can get there by winter, what's your take on this long intro to ask your question for a take?
Well, it's complicated, and editorial writers are supposed to be able to tell the difference between somebody who screws up something easy, you had one job, and a very difficult issue that is hard to solve. And this is a difficult issue that is hard to solve. For a very long time, we dumped the homeless people over in the Road Home shelter, and the Road Home shelter was pedaling just as fast as they possibly could to keep people from starving and freezing. And we all said, hooray, that's great, because that means we don't have to deal with it. Well, as downtown picked up and people, that real estate over where the Road Home and Pioneer Park and the Gateway became more valuable, and the analogy I've used 100 times on this show is like they discovered gold on the Sioux Reservation, so all of a sudden the Indians had to move. And to our credit, we said, well, we're not just going to throw them out. We're going to come up with a new system. It's going to be a lot more active. It's not just going to be passive and keep people up from freezing to death. We're going to get them services, find them housing. If they need mental health care, if they need substance abuse treatment, if they're eligible for services like Social Security disability and things that they didn't even know about, we'll get that for them. We'll help them. We'll be active. We'll get them out of this, and instead of just having to warehouse them someplace. That's the direction in which they're headed. It looks hopeful, but like so many other things, public or private, you're trying to put these three buildings together and get these programs open. Of course they're going to be behind schedule. That's just the nature of the beast. It looks good, but at the same time, and they're asking now for more volunteers to help with the thing.
Right.
So even if these things open and are active and are funded and are kept clean and are kept safe, we haven't solved it. We've moved down the road.
Bethany, just to close the story out, there was a call issued for volunteers because the service providers, the homeless service providers, see a big need for volunteers. What did they say?
Yeah, exactly. They said that they'll really need especially groups of volunteers at the women's shelter, which is the first one to open. So groups of about 20 to help serve meals and stuff like that. And they also need donations of clothing and hygiene products. And so you can find more about that on the websites of the three operators of the shelters. So that would be Catholic Community Services of Utah, Volunteers of America Utah, and the Road Home.
Okay. Bethany, I want to squeeze, before we head to a break, I want to squeeze in one more story that you covered this week having to do with medical marijuana law that passed at the state legislature. This is kind of a big turn away from homelessness and actually away from comments made by the president earlier in the show, an eclectic show today. But This is a story about how that medical marijuana will be produced. For a time, we were only going to see businesses and residents in Utah being able to get the growing licenses for medical marijuana. That rule has changed, right?
Yeah. So initially, the idea was that, as you said, only Utah-based businesses could apply for one of these 10 cannabis growing licenses. And since there's only 10 of them, they're, you know, you'd have to think going to be extremely valuable to people. And so the interest, I guess, was in, you know, prioritizing local businesses first. But the Department of Agriculture and Food ultimately concluded that might run afoul of federal law, and that, you know, they couldn't prohibit some kind of interstate competition. And so they recently put out an RFP to receive bids from people who are interested in becoming growers. And they did not restrict that to Utah-only businesses. Now they're changing the rules, the draft rules, to kind of catch up with that.
How will these licenses be given out? And when, I mean, actually, weren't they already supposed to have been given out?
They were, but 81 different applications came in. And someone from the department told me that the average length was 50 pages to 300 pages. So that's a lot for the department to kind of go through. And they ended up having to delay it until the end of the month, the awarding of the licenses. But they're apparently sequestering themselves in libraries and reading through these applications.
Okay, so there will be 10 in the end. And as you said, these can go to outside, say, companies that are outside of the state of Utah. They all have to be grown here in Utah. The
yes.
marijuana all has to be grown
yes.
here in Utah. Okay. And then the time frame on when people who are trying to access medical marijuana can do that?
So the state's goal is to, and this is actually part of the application, the applicants have to demonstrate that they could have product ready like early part of 2020. So within a few months, they're going to have plants in the ground, and the products should be available January to March of 2020.
All right. George, I don't know. Do you want to comment on this?
Again, this is complicated. It's probably more complicated than anybody thought it would be. They had the proposition on the ballot that we want to have medical marijuana, and the legislature says, well, but we're the legislature, so we get to say how we have medical marijuana. And as is normal for the legislature, they kind of make this stuff up as they go along, the idea of long process with hearings and listening to experts. Now, we don't do that here. So they're figuring it out, but it looks like it will work, but stay tuned.
Stay tuned indeed. All right, that's Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, and we need to take a break. And when we come back, we'll turn to Senator Mike Lee and his actions on funding for 9/11 victims. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, George Pyle, and Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. Thomas Burr, Washington bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune, coming back to you now on the show. Utah Senator Mike Lee was one of two senators who earlier this week blocked a vote on funding for compensation for this compensation fund for victims of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks. And Senator Lee got a lot of flack for doing that. Why does he say that he blocked that vote? And then maybe you can fill us in on what happened after that.
Yeah, sure. Let me just back up just a little bit. So just make sure everyone's on the same page. I assume everyone knows this fund was set up in the aftermath of 9/11, and it's meant for people who suffered or injured because of the attacks. So we're talking about the firefighters, the police officers, the first responders who, you know, ran towards the buildings while everyone else was running away. And a lot of them got sick because they were breathing in, you know, jet fuel fumes and toxic dust. And it was just really a horrible, place to be working, but they were there because they wanted to save lives. So we have this fund, but it's running out of money now. And there's a bill that passed the House, I think it was like 402 to 12. It was overwhelmingly supported by people. And it came to the Senate, and Mike Lee objected. He put what's called a hold on the legislation, which means they wouldn't have a vote. And his objection is that it's essentially a blank check for 73 years. The legislation would fund the fund, put money into the fund through 2092. And Mike Lee says that's dangerous, that we should, you know, we should renew it for 10 years, give them $10 million for 10 years. But not just keep it going, you know, in perpetuity, essentially, until everyone is, you know, is gone who was a victim of this. And so it blocked a vote, and then Rand Paul, they blocked them bringing it up on the floor, but they tried to do it another way, and Rand Paul objected to that. He's the senator from Kentucky. His concern is that if we're going to, you know, spend this money, we should cut money elsewhere, that it should pay for itself in some form.
Okay. And there was also like a little bit of a suggestion from Mike Lee, if unless I'm misreading this, that there could be fraud, or that we're trying to prevent against fraud from happening, suspicion of fraud, maybe. Can you talk about that? Is that the same sort of?
Yeah. Sure. His whole point was we need to have some oversight, which is why he doesn't want to just extend it forever, that there should be some congressional oversight of this money and, you know, protections against any abuse. I will note that the special master, the person over the fund, testified last month before Congress that there's never been a single proven case of any fraud or misuse or abuse of the money since the fund's inception.
The comedian and former host of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, who has testified on funding for 9/11 first responders in Congress before, this is sort of a pet issue for him, and he was critical of Senator Lee, right?
He was very critical of Senator Lee and Rand Paul, and pretty much called them hypocrites, that they voted for, you know, the president's tax cuts last year, which add like $1 billion of debt annually going forward, but that it wouldn't fund money for, you know, firefighters and police officers who were saving lives on 9/11. And he went on CNN, he went on Fox News, and just blasted the senator.
Right, and again, as you said, it's that the senator had a desire to see it just funded for 10 years as opposed to 92 years. This story has evolved a bit. I think you wrote a follow-up. A deal was worked out to allow a vote on Senator Lee's amendment on this bill. What is that deal, Tommy?
Yeah, essentially, so they wanted to end this because it doesn't look good for anyone, to be honest. So Mike Lee negotiated with Senate leaders, and they're going to have a vote next week on Mike Lee's amendment for, you know, $10 billion for 10 years, Rand Paul's amendment, which I'm not really sure what that is yet, and then they'll vote on the actual legislation that the House passed. There's probably a chance that, you know, Mike Lee gets some support, but it sounds like everyone really wants to not be, you know, tarred with "we didn't help 9/11 first responders." So they're going to pass something, and the vote could be, you know, as early as Tuesday or Wednesday.
George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with Salt Lake Tribune. What is this all about? Fiscal responsibility is sort of the stated reason here. What's your take?
I don't know. Does Mike Lee not have anybody on his staff who will say to him, if you say this, this is how it's going to play out in the world? This is what Jon Stewart's going to say. This is what the Salt Lake, well, he doesn't care what the Salt Lake Tribune thinks. This is what they're going to say on CNN. And does he like that? Does he not get it? I mean, yeah, I mean, Washington should be more fiscally responsible and people should stop and ask questions. But, you know, this finally flew through the House after it hit a logjam. Jon Stewart came along and shamed him into doing the right thing. Whether it was Jon Stewart or somebody with the firefighters told us that they had Lee's promise that he would back this, he would go along with it. And then that's part of what they're mad about, is they feel like they were lied to. Government spends too much money. Government spends too much money without enough thought. This is the 9/11 first responders. I mean, go to the museum that's now at the site of it. I mean, I went to that a few months ago, and I, you know, kind of didn't even want to go in because I was afraid it was going to be pretty emotional, and it was. I don't know if Mike Lee's been there or not, but he ought to go.
Thomas Burr in D.C., any final thoughts on this? I mean, you said that these amendments are likely to fail, and then this will just get passed the way that it was originally introduced, right?
Yeah, it's just one of those enforced errors. It's like this is a crisis that seems like could have been a deal could have been struck before all of this came out, and it wouldn't be, you know, shameful. Some people have said this week an episode that literally didn't need to happen.
Okay. Remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also tweet at KCPW with questions and comments. You know, before we head to, well, we've got some time here, before we head to our underplayed stories, though, I want to add one more story from you, Tommy. This was has to do with a vote by Utah's lone Democrat in Washington, Representative Ben McAdams, on the minimum wage. Can you tell us about McAdams' vote here?
I almost forgot I wrote about that. That's how busy this week has been. So the House voted yesterday to increase the minimum wage. It would gradually increase to $15 by 2025. You know, this is something Democrats have promised for a long time. Ben McAdams opposed it, as did the rest of Utah's delegation, Republicans, as we expected. We were wondering how McAdams was going to vote. And his argument was, yes, you know, we should raise the minimum wage, but we should do it by, you know, regional economic forecasts. Like, for example, you know, $15 an hour in Washington, D.C. doesn't go as far as it does $15 in Salt Lake City. And he has a point there, but he always has to straddle that tough thing. He's in a Republican, you know, dominated district, Republican majority district, and so he sometimes has to make these tough calls.
You know, I'm going to turn this right over to George Pyle from the Editorial Voice Tribune. And George, the idea of a national $15 minimum wage, or a national wage increase for the minimum wage, as opposed to state by state or in different regions. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I disagree with the congressman. I think he should have just voted for it, partly because it would have been symbolic anyway, because there's no way it's going to get through the Senate while it's controlled by Republicans. So it would have been just a statement. I would kind of doubt that, you know, a whole lot of people are going to vote against Ben McAdams next year because he favored a minimum wage bill that didn't even become law. I don't know if he's got some donor breathing down his neck or what. And I think there is some argument to be made that, you know, a one-size-fits-all is not necessarily the way to go. But again, I mean, you come up with this objection at the last minute. It seems like you should have been raising that, and maybe he did, but raising it earlier and working on it in committee and trying to do something else. And then when the final bill comes up and it's, okay, this is what it is, even though you didn't get the amendments and changes that you would have liked, you should vote for it anyway. It's important.
Just on the political calculus there, I know that this week Mia Love, Representative Mia Love and Thomas Burr, I don't know if you covered this or I'm sure you saw it, suggested that she might run again against Representative McAdams, you know, if the candidate isn't there. This may have been last week, actually, who she feels is a worthwhile challenger to McAdams. I mean, is that... Are we really talking about political calculus for every single vote, including things like the minimum wage for Representative McAdams? Is that part of what he has to do to get reelected?
Like Jim Matheson before Mia and Mia Love and Ben McAdams, this is a tough district, and they I'm sure they think about how every vote's going to play. What Ben McAdams won by what 700 and something votes over Mia Love, so it's really, yes, every vote matters, and everything they do here is going to be looked at with a magnifying glass.
How about in terms, I mean, this is early yet, but in terms of challengers to Representative McAdams, is that something that's already kind of being sorted out, or do we know?
You know, I think there's several people looking at it, and I'm not sure who's really going to be in just yet, because we still got, you know, plenty of time before we get into that. But people need to start planning. So, you know, he'll definitely get, you know, several Republican challengers. He might even get a, you know, Democratic challenger from the left, depending on, you know, how progressive this, you know, the squad kind of pushes the party. But he'll definitely get challenged. It's definitely going to be a, you know, multi-million-dollar race, as it usually is. And we'll just see who actually jumps in the race.
All right. That's, again, Thomas Burr, Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have a little bit of time left in the show, and so I might turn back to Bethany Rogers for one additional story that you wrote about this week. And, Bethany, it's something that we've seen a number of cities around the state of Utah doing, And this is adopting an anti-abortion stance at the sort of local government level. Who is the latest city to jump on board with doing that?
Yeah, so it was Highland City earlier this week passed a resolution just declaring its belief that life begins at conception and basically taking a position in favor of laws that would restrict abortion further and euthanasia.
And you reported that this was the third local government to pass a measure like this. Utah County did it. Who were the others?
Riverton was the one before that. That was the first one that passed this resolution. And yeah, Utah County's resolution is basically identical to the one passed by Highland City this week.
Where is this coming from? I mean, is there a sort of unified effort I guess who's behind it?
Yeah, so there's a group that just formed last month called Abortion Free Utah that's really trying to get local municipalities to pass these types of resolutions. And they really have no practical impact, but the group has a belief that there will be kind of like this groundswell of support for passing abortion restrictions and that it will kind of embolden legislators at the state level to pass really tough laws on abortion.
And, of course, there's a national debate, questions about whether or not the Supreme Court will take up challenges to abortion law in any given state. How are abortion rights advocates responding to these resolutions and, I guess, the latest resolution in Highland?
So they think that they're inappropriate. They think that it's not proper for a city to kind of take a position on when life begins, that that's kind of a departure from their responsibility and sort of their purview. But they say that if cities want to prevent unplanned pregnancies, they could definitely expand access to contraception and sex education programs.
Okay. George Pyle, maybe just a quick comment on the resolutions. I mean, these are resolutions. Tommy was talking about the non-binding resolution on, you know, condemning the president's tweets. These are resolutions, but they're sending a message. What do you say?
Yeah, I think they're hoping that if enough cities do it, that the legislature will sit up and take notice. I think the legislature we have probably was already going to sit up and take notice. I mean, those of us on my side of the issue, of course, think it's none of the city's business. And those of us who think that abortion is safe, legal, and rare, or women are second-class citizens, period, end of discussion, wish they would butt out and do the other things that was mentioned about providing some real health care.
Okay. That's George Pyle, a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And at this juncture, we have to turn to the final segment in the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And maybe I'll bring Thomas Burr, Washington, D.C. bureau chief, back in on this. Tommy, what's your pick for underplayed story if you've got one ready?
I'll give you two really fast.
Okay.
So one is it's very underplayed this week, but it'll be overplayed next week. That is Bob Mueller is going to testify before Congress next week, and I'm sure that will eat up a lot of the cable news time and our headlines for sure. The other one's that this is kind of softly simmering here in D.C. I don't know how much you guys are hearing about it, but the debt ceiling, the debt ceiling is fast approaching, and Congress needs to raise it. Just to explain that for people, it gets very complicated, but it's essentially we've already put all this, these charges on a credit card, and now we're deciding whether we're going to pay the bills. You don't really get to decide if you're going to pay it. You have to pay it. And right now, the White House and Congress not getting along and trying to figure out how to do it.
All right. And we've had, government shutdowns in the past. We will see what happens as a result of debate over the debt ceiling. Those are Tommy Burr's picks. George Pyle, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
Oh, if it's underplayed, I haven't heard about it. This week has been so depressing and so awful about everything. I'm going to spend the weekend luxuriating in the 50th anniversary of the moon landing when Americans knew what they were doing.
Okay, George Pyle, wistful with his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. And Bethany Rogers, your choice.
So I really loved this story about this big black raven that escaped from the Tracy aviary and hung out for a month at the Utah Attorney General's office, tapping on the window and begging for food.
It had a name, right? They gave it the name, the author.
Edgar?
Edgar, yes.
Yes, yes, but its actual name was Cash.
Okay, so the name at Tracy Aviary was Cash.
Yes.
And it got back to Tracy Aviary?
Yeah, they figured it out and returned the bird to its
home. And everybody was bringing out their Edgar Allan Poe, the Raven, Nevermore puns.
On Twitter especially.
On and on.
Yeah. All right. That's a great pick from Bethany Rogers. Check it out at sltrip.com. I'm going to go with, I've got a couple here. One is this tidbit from reporter Scott Pierce. The world's first officially licensed Downton Abbey-themed escape room is here in Salt Lake City. Right here in Salt Lake City, the mystery escape room at the Gateway got a license from NBC Universal as a sort of test, and they've recreated the servants' hall, Mrs. Hughes's office, if you know the show, and then the hallway between them in the lower levels of the Abbey. This is the set of the masterpiece PBS show. And we'll see if people actually want to visit it. I don't know when it's opening, but check it out at sltrip.com. The other one that I'm going to go with is this a story of Utah Supreme Court weighing in on a Ward basketball game or on an injury sustained in a game at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints meeting house. There's even a complete play-by-play of the incident from the bench. And there's a pun to be made there, but I can't quite get there. Basically, the court says you can expect to be injured when you play sports due to incidental contact. So play hard, everybody.
You knew the job was dangerous when you took it.
Right, exactly. George Pyle, Thomas Burr, and Bethany Rogers, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this show at kcpw.org. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis, our programming and operations director here at KCPW, for his help on the show, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. Again, thanks for joining us. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be back again next week.